This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
You're with ABC Radio National, and today on Hindsight, Bill Bunbury reports from the East Kimberley, where he retraces a long and sometimes difficult road to reach a native title agreement between the Mirrawung and Gidja peoples and the mining company Argyle Diamonds, a subsidiary of Rio Tinto. And a warning that Indigenous Australians may hear the voices of deceased people in this program.
I've been flying north for just over 2 hours. We left Perth early this morning. Down below, dry wheat paddocks. Next real landmark, the Stark Pilbara Ranges. And in the last few minutes, we've seen the cresting dunes of the Great Sandy Desert, ochre-coloured, slide under the wing. And now we're approaching the Argyle Diamond Mine in the spectacular red ranges of the East Kimberley. It's huge. Piles of waste material, gravel roads and earth movers, looking tiny from here. And coming into view, what's left of a mountain? Its neatly terraced sides showing how much ore has been taken out to find the precious diamonds. But this is also a place known as Barramundi Gap, part of the ancient Kimberley landscape, and now much changed by 25 years of mining. Barramundi Gap is crucial to this story because it also holds a dreaming story of vital importance to the Mirrawung and Gidja people of this region. And while Barramundi Gap has gone, destroyed by mining, its story still remains. And that's where closing the Barramundi Gap really begins.
The Barramundi Dreaming Story. Three women are chasing a Barramundi. The Barramundi swims into a cave, the cave we call Barramundi Gap. The women try to catch her. Feeling trapped, the Barramundi tries to swim out of the cave. But she cannot get out and has to swim towards the women waiting with their nets. They try to catch her, but she jumps over them, shedding her scales into the water. The scales are brightly coloured and sparkle in the sun. They are the diamonds we find today. Now the Barramundi jumps through a gap in the rocks into deep, clean water. As she dives, she turns into a white rock. The three women chasing her look down into the water to find her, and they too turn to stone. Today, the white rock and three stones can still be seen.
The Dreaming Story of the Barramundi, a story that's been told and retold for thousands of years, but a story now set against a much changed landscape.
Traditional owners never wanted the development of the Argyle Diamond Mine site. The mine site was right near a very significant site and continues to be a significant site for senior men and senior women. The impact on this site has been huge. The physical impact has been incredible. The diamond mine is one of the biggest diamond mines in the world and has literally moved a mountain. And it's that continued impact that traditional owners continue to see, that open-cut mining, things will never be the same.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's desecration of something that's historic to us. I mean, it's the same as people going into a church or something and destroying that. You know, I mean, it has effect throughout the Aboriginal community. So it has affected us, but what's done is done as we see it now, and we have to move on and try and get a better future.
When I interviewed one of the mining company representatives, the late Frank Hughes, he died recently, I remember when I was speaking to him, he said even at that stage they didn't realise just how big that mine was going to be. They knew it would be of value, but they really didn't realise that it was going to be as massive as it is, because it's the largest diamond mine by volume of production in the world. I mean, it's a big, physically a big mine for diamonds. So I think that if, I mean, Frank Hughes was a very enthusiastic man, if he hadn't have imagined how big it was going to be, then it would have been very difficult for Aboriginal people to have that imagining about what it might be.
Anthropologist Kim Doohan, and before her, traditional owner, or TO, Ted Hall. Back in 1983, the ABC's Bob Pride reported on early mining developments at Argyle.
The first diamonds were found here in 1976, but it was several years before damage to sacred sites plunged CRA into conflict with Aborigines and their supporters. Those allegedly desecrated included Barramundi Gap, said to be of enormous significance in local mythology, and Devil Devil Springs, where a dam was constructed.
When this mine was set up, it did change the landscape, didn't it? I mean, the Barramundi Gap mustn't look like the way your ancestors remember it.
No.
Does that matter?
Well, a lot of people, for what would happen. We all, feel sorry, but now we just can't put it back again. Too late.
Following the diamond discoveries of the late 1970s, the mining company CRA began alluvial mining at Argyle. They also came to an understanding with some of the local indigenous communities whose land adjoined the rapidly expanding mine. Director of RPM, Rosewood Project Management in Kununurra, Rosie Sandover, and that understanding.
An agreement was struck with the traditional owners. It was quite a sort of piecemeal agreement of, well, we want to mine this country, do you want to sign this piece of paper? There was no involvement from the land councils. It was a direct discussion with the old man who has passed away and two of his siblings. It wasn't put into any context of, well, you know, are we talking about an agreement of country? Who belongs to this country? Who are the significant elders of various tracts of country? None of those sorts of things were taken into consideration.
That agreement was made only to a certain number of persons there, but they have forgotten these people of Turkey Creek. They originated from that area, and most of these people are belong to that Daywal. All these people here you can see around here.
With the money that you get now, there's a good neighbour agreement. That's not enough. You need more than that.
Well, they don't get enough. Not enough to go around. They can't keep them all in there in this little corner. They've got to let all these young fellas and married people out onto another block or something. You can see how they are now. They're just sitting around in a little gundi here. Nothing much. No jobs. They want their money to be paid to them. And if they get the land, well, they use that for that too, purpose, yeah.
Traditional owners and the 1980 Good Neighbour Agreement, as CRA's plan was called.
That agreement was done very quickly. Interestingly, Aboriginal people, and I think people who worked for CRA at the time, had no idea of the scale of what the mine would turn out to be.
Simon Nish, lawyer, and later to work on a quite different agreement with CRA's successor, Rio Tinto.
So you had real issues about informed consent, and the speed at which the agreement was made had a number of implications. It meant that there wasn't much widespread community consultation, that the community didn't really have a chance to grapple with what they were consenting to. The community had very little experience with mining, so they didn't have the time to actually engage with what was being proposed. But not all the traditional owners for that area were involved in the process or involved in executing the agreement. The agreement was signed by a small number of people in Perth with a lawyer they didn't know. So it had lots of flaws in terms of openness and inclusiveness and query whether it had a solid basis of informed consent.
Before the Good Neighbour Agreement was signed, there was discontent. Primarily it was because the company at that time chose to deal with a very limited number of individuals who they saw as being representative of a larger community of Aboriginal people who had an interest in the mine area. And so other Aboriginal people who had other kinds of relationships to that landscape wanted to feel included in the process and to feel that they had been adequately consulted and that they would be appropriately recognised. That lingered for 20 years.
Yeah, that's right. It was a small agreement and was passed through very quickly. There was no other input from other main TOs. The Argyle Diamond Mine is mining right on the boundary between two traditional groups, your Gija and your Mirrawong people. So a lot of people needed to have a say within that mine, within the mining contract and the agreements. But the original was so fast and quick that nobody had a chance.
None of the non-Aboriginal people who were around in 1980 were still involved in Argyle, but virtually all the Aboriginal people who were the key players in 1980 are still alive and are still very prominent in their communities and in leadership roles. So history for Aboriginal people is live, and they would recount things that happened 15, 20 years ago as freshly as if they were yesterday, and the company people were struggling to acknowledge that history was so relevant to today, and then struggling to actually relearn it so that there was a common base of understanding for going forward.
There was huge concerns about the transparency of discussions during the time, whether people were really aware of what they were signing up to, what they were being told.
Kimberley Land Council Chair Wayne Bergman.
And the Land Council made a number of statements and presentations and wrote to the company and expressed concern that it was inappropriate in those early days how those discussions were going ahead with individuals. It wasn't a happy situation for traditional owners. I've spoken to a number of people who are around in those times from the mining side, and they strongly argue that, you know, it was world's best practice at the time because little was known about doing agreements with traditional owners. I don't really accept that, but I think at the time the company was, in its view, was trying to do the best it could. But it was quite clearly that it wasn't a harmonious kind of process that went forward.
It certainly wasn't a breakthrough in contemporary terms, but it was in the early 80s. It was the first ever agreement made in Western Australia. It was in the face of quite dramatic opposition from the state government. The company had made a smart business decision about expediting what they saw as a valuable resource. So it wasn't a philanthropic act. It wasn't a political act in terms of recognising Aboriginal land rights. I think there was a kind of respect in it. It's not quite the way that we would articulate those sorts of respectful relationships today. But I had the opportunity to interview some of the people who made that agreement with the Aboriginal people at the time. And I really feel that they had a genuine interest, however it was constructed, in assisting Aboriginal people, but they never denied that it was also a sound business decision about ensuring the security of the mine. They entered that agreement well before they had any regulatory approvals from the government to actually have the mine operate.
The fact is, however, that they were agreements. They were not relationships. They were signed up as, this is the stuff that we will do if you allow us access to the land.
Brendan Hammond, former Managing Director, Argyle Diamonds. He'd previously worked for Rio Tinto in Namibia and joined Argyle in 1998 as General Manager, Operations.
As history moved on, by the time the late 90s arrived and I got to Argyle, those agreements were no longer anything like good.
So what had changed in the interim?
History had moved on, expectations had changed, and certainly with my arrival at Argyle, the view of the place of a mine like Argyle in a local landscape underwent a dramatic change. Closure was imminent in 2001, so the mine was seen by everybody who worked on it as being right at the end of its life cycle. And secondly, Argyle had from inception been established as a remote fly-in fly-out operation, which effectively insulated itself from the regional community. There was certainly a time when the management staff of the mine lived and worked in Kununurra. That ended in the mid-90s, and the mid-90s onwards, Argyle was a microcosm world of its own up in the Kimberleys with very little or no real contact with the regional communities. except insofar as there was the old set of good neighbour agreements. And to be honest, those agreements had descended into what I viewed at the time to being pretty much a cargo cult.
A 1980s flashback here.
What are they doing?
Flattening the hill for the mining.
You happy? Is that okay? Is that okay for them up there?
Yeah. Yeah. For some people.
Whose land is it?
That's more land. Because every year we get them new trailer. They give us every year those mining money.
What else they give you?
New store.
With the shed, the store.
Yeah.
And you let them have the land? Is that okay then?
Yeah, then buy them off us.
And please, it really is important to stress that this is not through any poor management or ill will on behalf of anybody who was working at Argyle. Everybody who was working at Argyle in the area of community relations, as it was called at the time, was without doubt doing the very best that they thought was possible in terms of relationships with Aboriginal people. And at a person-to-person relationship, we were all friends. But the relationship was without doubt one of continuing the inequity of the good neighbour type of agreement and continuing the sort of dependency that pure payments type agreement result in.
There's also the issues of contemporary value of what an agreement should be. Certainly the Argyle Diamond Mine was very valuable. There was criticism in the early days that the financial value of the good neighbour agreement didn't reflect the overall value of the mine. There were concerns by a lot of Aboriginal people that the way that the value of the Good Neighbour Agreement and the Good Neighbour Program was constructed didn't allow them to make the sort of choices that they wanted to in relation to how that value would be realised.
Absolutely. We all have some form of ownership over all natural resources in the world. These mines, all mines, are dependent on their ore reserves. Their ore reserves are mineral deposits, which are non-renewable resources. Those non-renewable resources don't belong to the mines. They belong to, in my mind, a nested set of owners who, if viewed as rings of an onion, at closest proximity you have the traditional owners, you then have a regional community, you have a state community, you have the national community, and ultimately you have the rest of us on the planet.
Brendan Hammond, Managing Director, Argyle Diamonds, 2002-2005. He envisaged a new agreement with traditional owners, replacing the 1980s Good Neighbour arrangement. But in his view, a new agreement meant breaking with the past.
The initial engagement with Aboriginal people was in actual fact fraught with difficulty. It was not an easy relationship to start with at all, because I determined that in order to change the game and create a new relationship, we needed to sever the old. And there was no easy way to do this. I engaged in dialogue with the people who I could. I said to them that I had decisions to make, that I had to turn the mine around, that I saw them as being absolutely key partners in any future, but that part of establishing a new relationship had to be that the old one stopped and stopped immediately. So I didn't just step on the hose of the cargo cult. I turned the hose off and severed the pipeline.
And what had been in that pipeline?
In addition to the standard good neighbour payments, there were literally millions of dollars a year flowing out from Argyle through all sorts of very poorly governed processes, through fuel, through food, through all ad hoc. It was just adding to the whole dependency relationship. That caused a significant reaction in the local communities, and people were very angry with me. The result of that is that I was taught a very sharp lesson. That wasn't to change the outcome, it was to teach me a lesson that there were better processes to engage in. Part of that sharp lesson actually involved building a much closer relationship between myself and the traditional owners and communities. And if there is any lesson that I have about how to do business between corporate Australia and Aboriginal people, it is that it is absolutely necessary for general managers and managing directors to themselves not abdicate their accountability of getting to know their equals in Aboriginal communities, so that you have a situation where boss of country knows, understands and respects boss of business and vice versa.
When that agreement began, did the traditional owners wonder why it was happening? Because mining companies didn't usually do this.
No. We didn't know. Us four, my family, like my two sisters and my brother, we missed out for that first agreement. We'd like to get a better agreement, a new one, like one that today we got. Really good now.
Traditional owner Chocolate Thomas. I'm Bill Bunbury, and today in hindsight, the story of the Argyle Diamonds Agreement with traditional owners of land around the Argyle mine in East Kimberley. Both signed a new participation agreement in 2005. But as Rosie Sandover recalls, a new deal took time and effort.
It was a long, arduous process. It was hard fought on both sides, hard negotiations. It wasn't by any shape or form. There was times when traditional owner group walked away from the negotiating process.
There was a lot of suspicions out there. If you get bitten by a snake that many times, you're not going to go back and touch that snake. You really have to play that game with caution. So we thought, well, hang on, let's approach looking at this agreement again, but very cautiously. So that's why a lot of the elders within this new agreement actually brought in some of us young Aboriginal people who have got a little bit of education to try and negotiate a better deal for us. So everything up here in the Northeast Kimberley is handled with caution.
I think there was suspicion about what it would turn out to be, doubts about the longevity of it, and they'd had 20 years of there being a fairly fast turnaround of personnel within the mine that they'd built up relationships with, so I think people were a bit dubious about could there be a fundamental shift in the relationship that actually endured beyond changing personalities.
No negotiation is an easy process. It took us 3 years of full-on negotiation. We did have Kimberley Land Council representing us as spokespersons, but the main spokesperson was us. We basically done a lot of our own negotiation. We had other people there to give us directions, but the main involvement came from the main traditional people.
What sort of things got in the way when you were talking with the company? Were there things that you were very concerned about that you wanted to stress to the company that were important to you?
Respect was one of the main things that we wanted Argyle Diamond to respect us for who we were. We are, and we know that we are the traditional people of this country. We haven't signed the land over to anyone, We're still TO people up here in this country.
All of us at Argyle had to prove by action, by deed, that we were serious and that we were committed and that we would stand by the commitments that we had made, because Aboriginal people have been rooted over many times by many people for hundreds of years. They've seen this stuff come and go. I was talking naturally to the same people who are up there now who could remember sitting on the ground talking to the original Charles Court and co. about Argyle. They've got very long memories. They're there much, much longer than any of us are as corporate officers, and seen things come and go. And it took a long time to build particularly the trust. I think the respect was easy, the trust came second. But it was only after the respect and trust that we could actually get into the game of really opening up the box and getting into mutual obligations and future partnerships.
We couldn't undo the past. We needed to try and do the best thing for the future. And traditional owners then became focused on how were they going to let go of the anger that people had felt from the past, to how do we make this work for now, and how do we put in place in the mining agreement things that are important for the future, and not just for our immediate future but for generations to come. There's been huge concerns about the impact of the mining operations on people's belief systems. The mine area is essentially in an overlap area that involves a number of groups. There were two main groups that had responsibilities for the belief systems in the area and were told by two different language groups, Merrong in the northern area and Gidger in the southern area. And the landholding groups that had responsibility told those stories slightly different. And it was a matter of how we brought all those right people together and work out how do we move forward on a common basis.
When you look at the original photographs and you look at Barramundi Gap, you realise, of course, as you fly over the site, that the physical nature of the land has been very much altered at that point. Did Aboriginal people express sorrow about that, the actual change to the rock and therefore the story of the creation of the White Rock and so on?
There was grief and anger expressed about damage to country, but what was, I think, one of the extraordinary features of this process is that as we moved through it, there was an acknowledgement on both sides that there could be, and there in fact was, two cultures coexisting in the one geographical space. I think our mindset had been Barramundi Gap is irrevocably damaged and it's gone. What emerged is the landscape has changed, but the site remains, the significant remains, the stories and songs remain, and there happens to be mining on that place. And I think one of the unique things about the agreement and the outcome is that two cultures are able to acknowledge that there are two cultural frameworks, independent of each other, but coexisting in the one geographic space.
When you're talking about Indigenous people's relationship to the land, it's a very complex, composite picture. Often when we're looking at the landscape, we tend to see the physical material manifestations. I mean, we might focus on plants or birds or, but for Aboriginal people, it also embodies and embedded in the landscape are relationships to themselves, to the dreaming, to other people, and spirits in the landscape, the spirits of the deceased. So the number of issues that Aboriginal people have to deal with when they make a decision about a piece of physical space, the landscape, are far more complex, I think.
If we're talking about protection of sacred sites, obviously cultural history needs to be a big major role in there. That's where the role of the elders play, telling the history of who these young people are, giving them identification, identity, so they know that the country is also something more than just land, you know? I mean, Aboriginal people believe that that's our mother, you know, I mean, when we finish, we go back to it.
In order for two cultures to meet, I think you have to have a reasonably clear understanding of your role and your impacts, which enables you to actually hear the other. Aboriginal culture is extraordinarily strong in that part of the country. You know, people speak language, law is very, very strong, and mining culture is very strong. And they are quite different cultures with not much in common. But what we succeeded in creating was some space where the two cultures were able to mutually hear and listen and speak with each other and actually find some middle ground.
I'm not sure that they met in the sense that each understands each other completely, and I think that that's not necessarily a desirable outcome. I think the meeting was the acknowledgement that difference exists, that it's very real, that it's no less value because it's different, even if it's not understood.
Anthropologist Kim Doohan, who with Professor Marcia Langton prepared a report for Argyle Diamonds negotiations with TOs, traditional landowners. By the 1990s, Argyle Mining had begun to look at other aspects of a future agreement. It was one of the TOs' key requests.
Traditional owners felt very strongly about employment and training. If you look at the history of Argyle, prior to this native title agreement, the Eliwa, there was very limited Aboriginal employment. Aboriginal employment only increased after the Native Title Agreement. And that's really significant because it shows that Aboriginal people saw that as very important, and we were able to convince the company and the leadership in the company that this was a stopper. If the company wasn't going to change their practices and to ensure the number of Aboriginal people employed and involved in the wider benefits of an operational mine, then there would be no deal.
Employment opportunity is very small around here. And back then, we're talking back in the 80s, you know what I mean? It was still hard for the Indigenous people. I'm not playing no sorry fiddle or anything. That's just a fact of life. That's the way it was back then.
We commissioned a very in-depth study of this region in 1993, termed the Taylor Report.
Kevin McLeish, Argyle Diamonds General Manager Operations.
And the description that it gave of the life of Indigenous people in this region was shocking, in fact. If you don't count welfare or CDEP as being employment, then the real Indigenous unemployment rate here is about 74%. So, you know, anything we can do to be able to provide opportunities for people, particularly Indigenous people, I think is a big step forward in terms of improving their lot. Because at the end of the day, it is those opportunities that give people hope.
When I arrived and I found the, I can't remember how many it was, but probably 10-odd Aboriginal people working inside the business, and I asked what it was they were doing. Well, they were all engaged in a bit of local road work. They cleaned cars and they did horticultural work, i.e. watered gardens. And this was our Aboriginal employment exercise. When I asked why, in terms of the level of employment and the numbers, I was told quite smugly at the time, "Brendan, you don't understand. Aboriginal people are not like Africans. They don't have the same sort of desire to work that you're used to. They find it impossible to be punctual, that their absence frequency rates are terrible. They don't actually want to work. They don't value money. And in any event, Brendan, there aren't enough Aboriginal people. So, you know, we've got all of them." Frankly, a pile of garbage. Fortunately, I'd heard this sort of thing previously in Africa from the same sorts of people in a different culture. So I knew that there was only one thing to do, and that was to change the game and, if necessary, change the people.
Senior management have said, we need to make this work. We need people to be employed at Argyle and we want to get them out of the Kimberley region. Do what you need to do it.
That makes economic sense, I guess, too, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if we're employing people from the local community, which is, you know, around 40k south of us, Warman, then obviously the money stays in the region, the skills get transferred around this region. It has benefits everywhere, I think.
Our first foray into Aboriginal employment was a failure. I forget how many people we employed, but we employed a cohort, and within 6 months that cohort wasn't there. They were gone. And I had to, together with the team at the time, look at this thing and say, well, how and why did this fail? And it was interesting. The reason it failed was because of a deep belief from both Aboriginal people and Argyle people that the exercise would fail. So with mutual expectations of failure, the exercise had no chance of success. So what we had to then do was to use the relationships that we were building with Aboriginal people and be very, very, very both supportive and, if necessary, brutal inside the business to change mutual expectations of failure into mutual expectations of success, and making absolutely sure that we were getting the right people in, that they would succeed. And failure, by the time we did it the second time around, was not an option.
The participation agreement was signed in late 2005. In regards to the work that I do in employment and training, I suppose, we've been hard at it since late 2003.
What's been the effect of that? Have you seen changes in the way Aboriginal people have responded to opportunity to work in a mine?
Oh, absolutely. I think not just their attitude towards working in a mine, but attitude working in general, I think. I suppose what they bring to the mine is a bit of cultural change for us, which we've got to learn to adapt to. But the skills they've got, they've predominantly been working on pastoral stations and whatnot around the area, so they're useful skills. It's up to us to actually help them, and then they can transfer those skills with us.
Ray Chamberlain, Superintendent Community Relations and Work Readiness at Argyle.
What we've been able to do is create opportunities and employment for people who probably may well have missed out in some cases. And although a lot of these people now probably aren't working at the mine, they've gained skills that has allowed them to work in various organisations right across the Kimberleys. So now what we're starting to see is, whereas once I would pack my swag up and go looking for people and talking to families and communities about employment, we're now starting to get those people that are on CDP and whatnot calling us up to say, you know, what are the opportunities out there? Although we still put the swag in the car and go hunting.
The issue about these agreements is not so much what we can have in writing, although that's a very important aspect of doing agreements, but there's been a major shift in recognition that the mining industry needs to engage with Indigenous people, and they need to have a transparent process to settle how mining operations will go forward from now on, rather than having any disjointed or disgruntled traditional owners about how to move forward in the future.
At that time, the Mirrawong-Gadgerong High Court appeal was in play, and I stood up to talk, and I said to Aboriginal people that, as far as I was concerned, native title was a matter of fact. It was not something that we would wish to contest or even discuss, that it was a matter of fact, and that I was not interested in observing native title as a Western legal process of bundles of rights, etc., etc., but that I viewed it as being the key to establishing the right relationship between Argyle and Aboriginal people, which is that Aboriginal people are Argyle's landowners, and that Argyle have a tenancy relationship with Aboriginal people.
Working with traditional owners on the ground, we had a huge consultation process. The first 8 months involved formally identifying the traditional owner group. It involved a lot of field work, a lot of on-the-ground work. It became a process of working quite intensely with traditional owners rather than just having experts like lawyers and economists and commercial advisors and, you know, anthropological advisors and legal advisors. It became a process to grow people up in the art of negotiations and to be clearly identify what they want.
The Aboriginal negotiating team was 26 people, and you would think that's completely unwieldy, but every decision they made was solid, it was unanimous. It took more time than decisions would under a non-Aboriginal system, but the decisions were rock solid. No one ever broke ranks. They were incredibly effective in a formal negotiation sense, and an informal negotiation sense, they were working the relationships very, very effectively.
Things got tough because it required the company representatives to step out of their comfort zone and really consider the impact of what traditional owners were asking for. So there were times when things we were able to reach mutual agreement really early and really quick, and there were other times when the negotiations on different issues took a lot longer.
As a negotiator, I felt outgunned and outmaneuvered absolutely every time.
So when it came to negotiate, was there an initial suspicion that this wouldn't be any different?
It's interesting. There's a senior Aboriginal woman, one of the women who speaks for Barramundi Gap, which is where the mine is, and I commented to her one day at the end of the process that the things she said and the things that Brendan Hammond said had a great deal of similarity. And she said, "Of course they do. I put him in his head. We dreamed him." So for Aboriginal people, it wasn't happen chance that the Argyle leadership came up with the approach that it did. From their point of view, they were active shapers of their world, and they were simply waiting for the right agent to come along, and then they influenced the agent in the way that they believed they could, and of course things panned out as they did.
Aboriginal people, I've been told, thought you might come along. Fair comment?
I, in the 8 years I've been in Australia, have been unbelievably privileged to have been welcomed first by Aboriginal people before white Australia, and then to be made to feel in a small way part of an Aboriginal family, and I mean that in the broadest sense rather than a family group. I am incredibly honoured for that to have happened, and I continue to learn on an ongoing basis about Aboriginal people and the astonishing depth of their culture. What I would say is that if they have said to you that they sung me into Argyle, then that's a matter of fact.
There was a period of 1 week a month, generally, where the company would come along and say, "This is what we want," and traditional owners will say, "Well, no, this is what we want. We want clauses in the agreement about employment and training, heritage protection." One of the major things that came out of the Argyle mine is this talk of the no means no rule. That means if we identify a site, you won't destroy it, that you will seek traditional owners' consent to deal with it. There's a version of this principle established in the Argyle agreement. And what's significant about it is this was so dear to traditional owners' heart, because they've had the impact of the existing operation and the impact of that operation on a site, and they wanted to ensure that any other sites in the area weren't going to be impacted on without their consultation and agreement about the best way to manage them.
Communication was a real challenge. Most Aboriginal people in the negotiating team spoke three or four languages, Mirong, Gidja, Malnyan, Wular, English, so we had interpreters at all the meetings. So language was a challenge, but probably more of a challenge was just trying to convey concepts both ways. And we made some grand mistakes. We spent a great deal of money getting a 3D model made of the mine, and you could pull it apart, and then inset into that was a model of the ore body. Partly we wanted to show the ore body because it would explain underground mining, and partly because there was a view that wherever people saw quartzite, that indicated the presence of diamonds, which meant the open pit would actually turn into some great long channel throughout country. So we wanted to assure people diamonds actually occurred in a very specific geological pipe. So I spent a great deal of money on this 3D model, and it was a complete disaster. Just people didn't get it. It just was not a useful communication tool at all. So then we produced some animations, and they worked a treat. But just trying to work out what was a useful way to convey stuff was very interesting.
Even more interesting when it came to Argyle's decision in 2001 to shift from open-cut excavation to mining underground at Barramundi Gap.
Barramundi Gap is a pretty heavy-duty sacred site, and it has particular significance to Aboriginal women. That story's public, and they've said it can be public, so they've spoken about the Barramundi Gap passing through there on the way. It's sloughed off its scales and the scales of the diamonds. And part of that story is that the Barramundi is still embedded in that place, and so as you go underground, you're then into the guts of the Barramundi. So active underground mining's got very significant cultural significance for Aboriginal people. They understood what was at stake and the dynamics of the discussions in a far clearer way than we did, because at the very outset they said this is about respect and recognition, and we want to know if you're serious about respect and recognition, and will you go ahead with the underground expansion that you want to do without our consent? So they really just called a spade and said, are you serious? And we weren't quite ready for that. The position we came to was that we would not go ahead with the underground expansion without traditional owner consent.
I said to Aboriginal people that we would not engage in any development activity on the mine at all that they did not agree with. And indeed, they tested me quite severely on that at one stage. And I am very pleased to be able to say that we lived by that obligation, that when they told us that they were not happy, we stopped work. And we did not proceed again until they'd said it was okay for us to proceed. And that was with the underground project.
When Brendan Hammond said, okay, we'll do that, were people surprised that he committed himself to saying, I respect your decision?
I think the TOs more than anything. To come from a big mining boss, that was one of the major tick on the marker board, I guess you could say, because he's actually understood what we're going through and what we've been going through and how we've been living.
That was a major turning point in the negotiations. It signalled that we were very serious. It shifted the power dynamics in the negotiation. It was a bold move, it was a risky move, and it was the right move. But what was really interesting was that the traditional owners called at the outset, what's this about and are you serious? And as part of the recognition of two cultures operating in the one space, there were a great number of ceremonies performed as declines were put in, and as we progressed towards an underground mine, there were a great deal of ceremonies performed so the traditional owners could discharge their responsibilities for making it safe for that work to be done.
The local landowners also had practical concerns.
They were very concerned about things like dewatering and the potential of lowering the water table for their land. So we need to go through a process of both consultation and education, I suppose, that in fact the underground mine was going to be beneficial not only to Rio Tinto shareholders but also to the traditional owners.
Those sound like very practical concerns. Were they allied with spiritual concerns about the land?
Certainly in terms of their culture. Their culture doesn't just express itself on the surface. It is still as culturally significant underground, and in particular very significant for the women. This whole region, you know, whilst we may well have mined out Barramundi Gap, for them, spiritually, Barramundi Gap still exists. It's still a part of their dreaming story. So anything around that region is still very significant for them.
There has been a tendency, and perhaps it's because of the sort of Eurocentric way of thinking, that physical transformation of a landscape must necessarily mean that everything else that is part of that has undergone such a, in this case, violent transformation. I think what I really did learn in the last 6 years or so is that for Aboriginal people, you can't kill the dreaming. Whether or not Aboriginal people are happy about how it has been transformed, certainly some of the women that I was working with would say that the Barramundi would rather not have been driven deeply into the ground, and there were certainly ways of making that less painful for the Barramundi. But the Barramundi wasn't blown up, and I think that to me was quite an extraordinary revelation about the way that Aboriginal women have maintained their relationship with that being, the Barramundi, in the face of what all of us would see, you know, as impossible odds.
Nobody wants to see some of their things that hold history destroyed. What's done is done, you know. I mean, whether it's good intention or bad intention, at the time you had to see what it was for. Yeah, we know that it's gone. We can't bring it back. Once the mine goes, I mean, that's it, you know. But long as the history is continued, passing down through the generations, you know, I mean, we know that there's no monument there to say that that's where the Barramundi went to, but the history actually says that.
Traditional owner Ted Hall. And in a way, a new history has been written at Argyle, an acceptance of difference between two different cultures, but also a history of their conversation.
Aboriginal people have managed to be very consistent in their trying to overcome those lack of understanding between themselves and the miners in an unmediated way. I mean, effectively, they've been managing that program by themselves, that program of change. I don't think the company was managing a program of change. I think they just thought that things had been established and they were just going on and they were managing eruptions. Whereas I think some of the Aboriginal people in the East Kimberley were on a very consistent program. And I think it's important to remember that in 1980, when the agreement was made, the nation didn't recognise that Aboriginal people had any rights. It wasn't in our consciousness. So to expect a mining company who, you know, really just wants to mine and meet the needs of the nation and the and their shareholders was, you know, perhaps a bit foolish. And it may well have been that if we, as workers in that process, had been more able to reflect with the hindsight that we have now, things would have been a bit different. But I still think that for them to see what we call suspicion and bad behaviour as more ignorance and lack of understanding was perhaps a much more, ultimately, a much more creative way of looking at the relationship between Aborigines and miners.
That suggests, doesn't it, that they've been very patient with us?
Oh, extraordinarily. Can't believe it. Really. I mean, I just think that it is quite extraordinary. And look, just from on a personal level, I mean, my relationship started in 1982 and I've been in and out of Warman and the East Kimberley and around mining for a very long time. And I just think that, you know, people have spent a lot of energy on trying to get me to understand what was really going on. And, you know, that's, you know, over 20 years of effort. It's more than what we've had.
With anybody coming in who's unaware, you know, you have to have a stumble before you can walk in anything, I guess. It's been a learning block, but it's built up a lot of respect and trust between the TOs and the mining company.
I think it transformed the mine. It was a profound way of the traditional owners being acknowledged. It was a profound way of the traditional owners physically exercising two cultures in one place. But also for the mine workers, it says to us all that this mine doesn't occur in an empty landscape. This mine occurs in a very rich cultural landscape and we're actually going to be part of it. Almost all the staff at Argyle that I talked to just felt enriched by having access to part of this extraordinary culture that was being performed on the mine.
Look, I've been in the Kimberleys most of my life. My kids have grown up in the Kimberleys and all got jobs around the place. And I've had businesses here where I've employed local Aboriginal people. So to actually go out to a community and see their people actually getting work where they may not have been able to get work under normal circumstances is usually satisfying.
Have you, in turn, learnt from Indigenous people?
No doubt. I mean, obviously, being a non-Aboriginal person, I've had to learn everything from those guys, and I'm by no way a master of all their culture. I'm learning all the time from those. I respect their culture, and I think that is why, I suppose that's why we've been able to do what we do, that they know they've got to teach us how to go about all this, and the learning is fantastic. It's a great subject, and I think, once again, we need to make sure that we keep respecting their culture.
It was a matter of us mob and Argyle Diamond Mine actually going through the hurt and understanding the hurts that we've all faced, from the prior ones to the new agreement now. Now that a lot of the other TOs have actually had the opportunity to get up and have their say, Argyle Diamond Mine has become more aware of the pains and the hurt that we've been faced with, and that has built up the trust and the respect.
It was without doubt the most challenging process I've ever been involved in, to be on my feet and just feeling, you know, I've been doing native title work for a long time, and to be on my feet in front of a group of people and feel really poorly skilled and poorly equipped with and facing a group of 26 very, very adept negotiators. It was fascinating to struggle to find how to create a communication bridge to a different culture. The legal work was really interesting, and there was space to do very creative legal work. So, in summary, certainly the most challenging thing I've ever done, but without doubt the most rewarding thing I've done in my life.
Was it a learning curve for both parties?
Yes, it was. And as I say, I came in, I suppose, on the other side of that learning curve.
Current Managing Director, Argyle Diamonds, David Rose.
But I think for all of us that get involved in it, because we've come from different backgrounds, we've worked in different environments where this sort of fundamental relationship is not necessarily there. There was learning both ways, I think. But I think in particular for the mining company, learning more about the land and getting a genuine respect for the custodial processes that the traditional owners have. They have a genuine obligation within their culture around the land, and I think that fundamental understanding, really understanding that and taking the time to understand that is fundamental.
Aboriginal people have a very different way of engaging with the world, and that if that way of engaging with the world isn't treated with respect and acknowledged as being valid, then as a nation we lose, you know, a very important skill set about understanding our landscape. And from my experience with working with Aboriginal people, their understanding of the landscape brings in so many other factors that would enrich us as a society in dealing with this particular country.
Do you want Argyle Mine to become part of the Dreaming?
Well, that's a good question, because I think that can happen from what I've seen. Little I know of Aboriginal culture, I'm certainly aware of relatively recent stories that get captured in dance and song. And it would be lovely to think that'll happen. Certainly the Barramundi story, which is a story of Barramundi Gap and gives the cultural significance to the site that we mine, that story already incorporates why the diamonds are there, you know, that they are from the scales of the Barramundi, and that the colours of the diamonds also relate to features of the Barramundi. Maybe one argument would be that that's already happening in the sense of why the diamond mine's there in the first place. But yes, it would be, I think, an absolute privilege to think that this is a positive enough experience that it does get captured in song or dance later on.
Bill Bunbury produced today's Hindsight, Closing the Barramundi Gap, the story of a 25-year conversation between Argyle Mining and the Mirrawung and Gidja people of the East Kimberley. And Bill wishes to thank all the participants for sharing their experience of the agreement. Studio production for Closing the Barramundi Gap was by Ian Manning. Next week on Hindsight, we have a what-if story about the founding of Melbourne. Early settler John Batman, unusually for his time, bought the land around Port Phillip Bay from the Wurundjeri people for things like blankets, tomahawks and glasses. But if this deal hadn't been declared void by Governor Bourke, would Indigenous Australians' legal claim to their land have been established in 1835 instead of with Mabo in 1992? You're listening to ABC Radio National. And coming up in Airplay, Jane Ullman will bring you the third in a four-part adaptation of Stephen Sewell's controversial and powerful hit Myth, Propaganda and Disaster in Nazi Germany and Contemporary America. The play premiered in 2003. It became an immediate success and went on to productions around the world. That's right after the news. I'm Claudia Taranto, and I really hope you enjoy the rest of your weekend.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.